From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The U.S. team is alive at the World Cup, as are the surprising Swiss, whose defense is not full of holes. Meanwhile, South Africa's recent loss means they might as well go home, except they already are. Ahead on Only a Game, a World Cup update. Also, former UConn and WNBA star Rebecca Lobo on fathers, daughters, and sports. And a precipitous hill climb featuring several antique automobiles. Also, World Cup soccer, consular style.
I think I may be the only consul general who's turned out. It's very good. I'm a qualified diplomat, so if there's any international incidents, I shall step in.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In the late World Cup game yesterday, England and Algeria played to a 0-0 draw, so which teams will emerge from Group C will not be determined until the third round of games, which hardly renders Group C unusual. The host team delighted the Vuvuzela Blowers in the opening game of the tournament by scoring the first goal. South Africa had to settle for a 1-1 draw with Mexico in that game, and reality reared its unwelcome head when the Bufana Bufana met Uruguay on Wednesday and lost 3-1. Joining me now from South Africa is reporter Anjali Nayar. Hello, Anjali.
Hi, nice to be here with you.
How are fans of the host team bearing up after Wednesday's loss?
Well, I think everyone is slightly disappointed. I should say extremely disappointed in their national team. I think had they walked away with a tie or even less of a drastic defeat, it would have been okay with the South African side. When that last goal was scored against them, people just started leaving the stadium where I was watching with a group of boys. Everyone just started leaving as well.
There is little or no chance South Africa will get out of their group now. So to which team do the fans of the South African teams gravitate?
Well, there is a mathematical chance that Bafana Bafana could still advance past the group round. And people still on the street believe that Bafana Bafana can do this. They really believe that there is a way that something will happen, some divine intervention, and the team will advance past the group round. That being said, I think all of the African nations, including South Africa, are really hoping that at least one of the African nations will advance past the group round. So I think, you know, people just want at least one African nation to be in that semifinal, in that final, or perhaps take home the cup, so that the World Cup stays in Africa.
I should probably mention Bufana Bufana is the nickname for the South African team. I guess it loosely translates to the boys, the boys?
That's right, the boys of the nation. It's kind of a term of endearment for the national side.
We're just a week into the tournament. Have things gone reasonably smoothly so far as transportation, crowd behavior, and, of course, the delights of suddenly becoming a tourist center are concerned?
I think the expectations have been met for the most part. People, you know, the president today said, FIFA today said that they've been really pleased with how everything has gone. And for the most part, I mean, the atmosphere itself drives the entire tournament. So people are more willing to turn a blind eye to the little inconveniences. But there have been a lot of hiccups along the way. Several security personnel for the World Cup went on strike because of low pay, and the entire security operation for the games and so on had to be taken over by the police. There have been transit strikes leading to and from the games so that certain passengers were stranded. But people, by coming to this World Cup and by seeing it on television, have learned something about a continent that they probably didn't know anything about before. And that's really important, I think, to the entire continent. So South Africans, Africans in general, have just been pleased by the opportunity to show that there are more things in this continent than just disease, famine, and war.
Anjali Nayar is a reporter currently traveling throughout Africa. Anjali, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
If they'd beaten Slovenia yesterday, which they momentarily appeared to do, the U.S. would have been in control of their own destiny going forward. Now they aren't. On the other hand, if they'd lost, which it certainly looked like they would do for more than half the game, the U.S. would have been all but cooked. Joining me now to discuss whether the glass is half full or half empty is Greg Lallis, late of the New England Revolution, among other teams, and editor-in-chief of MLSsoccer.com. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Let's start with what looked like U.S. goal number 3, which would have been the winning goal in yesterday's game. Why was it disallowed?
You know, that's the question I think everybody is asking. The players, even Bob Bradley, the coach, is asking that same question. They've said nobody knows. Landon Donovan said immediately after the game that the referee refused to tell them what the call was. The only thing that we can seem to come up with is that maybe Michael Bradley was called for a foul, even though he was being mugged in the box. And then maybe Maurice Edu, the guy who actually got the goal, somehow was fouling someone just to get open, but if you watch the replay, there's no chance it could be that. So I think everyone is as flummoxed as you are.
Does the team you've watched against England and Slovenia look likely to beat Algeria in their final group game on Wednesday, Greg?
To be perfectly honest, yes. There's no doubt that this team can beat Algeria. From what we've seen from Algeria, it shouldn't present that much of a problem. For the U.S., I think we have all the tools with a guy like Clint Dempsey and Landon Donovan to attack on the flanks. But I think that if we can't beat Algeria, then, you know, we just don't deserve to go through, which is something we said about Slovenia. But now it's absolutely true. We have to beat them in order to go through.
I know that the World Cup is supposed to be serious business, and there will
be... No, there's no seriousness in the World Cup.
Yeah, I know. Just ask the Vuvuzela players. But I wanted to ask you, do you see a certain irony in the U.S. needing England to do something, perhaps, in order for the U.S. to go through?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this game is always doing these kinds of things. You know, the World Cup is full of these kind of strange little ironies where history and politics and all these things come together. And it all comes back around. It's one of the great things about this carnival that is the World Cup, I think.
Greg Lallis is the editor-in-chief of MLSsoccer.com. Greg, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's always great, Bill.
In the most striking upset of the World Cup's first round, Switzerland beat Spain 1-0 on Wednesday. Joining me now is Susan Fogel-Masika, an American journalist with Swiss Info. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
All right. Obviously, Spain was heavily favored in Wednesday's match. Did folks in Switzerland give their team any chance against that powerhouse?
They gave them a bit of a chance, but I don't think most people even dreamed that Switzerland would actually win. There was a lot of hoping, but I think when people made bets, I think they probably bet for Spain.
Well, let's back up for a minute. How big a deal is soccer in Switzerland? Are there public plazas filled with people watching on huge TV screens?
Soccer is huge over here. There's no avoiding it, actually. At the train stations, they have viewing areas. Even the national government took a 15-minute break to watch the end of the game. Now, Migro is the top supermarket chain in Switzerland, and they said the day before the match, listen, if Switzerland wins, everything's 10% off the day after. I don't know if they were counting on that happening, but indeed.
It seems to me that the supermarket should have been aware of the odds. It should have been 50% off, don't you think? But maybe that never happens in Switzerland.
Yeah, the bargains aren't quite as good over here, I'm afraid.
Well, of course, beating Spain is bound to raise expectations. I'm wondering if the chatter around the water cooler in Switzerland now is about how the Swiss will trounce Chile on Monday.
Well, even the coach of the Swiss team says that this is going to be a lot harder than beating Spain. So I think right now most people in Switzerland are just basking in this victory. They'll worry about the next game when the time comes.
What happens if Switzerland does go through? Does this cause even more of an uproar there at home?
Well, then you really won't be able to control the people. This was only the first match, and I'm from Lucerne. That's where I live, and traffic was stopped for about an hour in the center of town because people were driving back and forth, waving flags, honking their horns. So whether they can beat Chile next Monday, who knows? But I think there'll be absolute pandemonium if they do.
Susan Fogel-Masika is an American journalist with Swiss Info. She joined me from Switzerland. Thank you very much, Susan. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bill.
The last time the U.S. Open golf tournament was played at Pebble Beach, Tiger Woods made a hash of it. He won the event by 15 strokes. Before the Open underway this weekend at Pebble Beach began, golf writer John Feinstein opined on the impact that startling achievement and the subsequent notoriety Woods has brought down upon himself for matters unrelated to golf has had on Opens since.
Who won the Open last year? Does anybody remember? It was Lucas Glover. So when you handicap a major championship, last year, did anybody pick Y.E. Yang to win the PGA? Did anybody pick Angel Cabrera to win the Masters? No, that's the beauty of golf. There's 156 guys teeing it up, and I'm not going to say any of them can win, but a lot of them can.
Following the cut late yesterday, a lot fewer than half that number have a shot at winning this year's Open, and whoever does win the tournament is likely to be a lot closer to par than Tiger Woods was when he lapped the field. Sean McKeel managed a 2-under 69 on Thursday, after which he was asked if he was surprised that his colleagues on the course hadn't managed to score better.
I'm really not surprised at all. I mean, I just don't see 4 or 5 under out there at all.
That may have been something of a premonition, albeit an unwelcome one. Yesterday, Sean McKeel blew to a 76. At the top of the leaderboard halfway home sits one Graham McDowell, who's at 3 under par for the tournament. According to Sports Illustrated senior writer Alan Shipnuck, winning would propel Mr. McDowell's career into previously unexplored territory.
Graham McDowell is a nice player. He's got a good resume on the European Tour. Hits the ball straight and a little short, kind of classic U.S. Open grinder profile. He could. He's a threat. He's never won a tournament of this magnitude, clearly, but pretty seasoned international player, and I think he'll hang around.
Asked to pick an even longer shot for Open champion at the halfway point, Alan Shipnuck, currently at Pebble Beach, opted for youth.
Well, I think you have to go to Ro Ishikawa, 18-year-old from Japan. Has a tremendous resume on the Japanese tour. He won over there as a 15-year-old amateur. Shot 58 earlier this year to win a tournament, one of the all-time great rounds ever played in professional golf. But he hasn't done much in America, so there's some question marks about how good this kid really is. But I think he's definitely a very strong dark horse.
Though Tiger Woods, the once and perhaps future king of Pebble Beach, said late yesterday that he felt he was in a good position to challenge the leaders, at 4 over par, Woods is looking up at a lot of players. This is not so for another former champ, Phil Mickelson, also a serious contender. According to Shipnuck, lots of people picked Mickelson to win the Open, and there's reason to suppose they got it right.
All Phil, all the time here at Pebble Beach. I mean, he came in as the big story, the favorite, position to try and chase a Grand Slam, if you can pick this one off. And he played beautifully on Friday, got himself back in the tournament. He's won 3 times on this golf course previously at Crosby Clambake. He's the best player in the world right now. He's on the top of his game, and he's a guy to watch on the weekend.
Third round play in the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach resumes today. It's 19 minutes past the hour. What do you do if an angry bull comes charging right at you? You run away, of course. Who wouldn't? So on Monday, when that happened to Christian Hernandez, that's what he did, which dismayed the paying customers at the Plaza Mexico bull ring, where Christian Hernandez was a bullfighter. Or at least he thought he was, until that bull came charging at him, at which point he dropped his cape, ran across the bull ring, and leapt over a wall to safety. Though several months earlier Hernandez had been gored in the leg, he had believed he could return to his profession, but no. Recollecting Monday's performance in Tranquility, the former matador said, "There are some things you must be aware of about yourself. This is not my thing." Shortly after he jumped out of the bull ring, Mr. Hernandez learned that now his thing is being sued for breach of contract. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a steep hill attempts to repel antique cars in suburban Boston. But first, I am a father with daughters who played soccer and basketball, so a book titled Fathers and Daughters in Sports is okay with me. especially on the day before Father's Day. This particular book features an introduction by a mother who's played a little bit of basketball, Rebecca Lobo. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. I love being back.
Steve Rushen, sports writer and author who wrote an essay for the book, once told Rebecca Lobo that he had no use for women's basketball, and it turned out to be a pretty effective pickup line because they're married and have three children. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you. I told her that line in a dark bar. That was the most effective thing I did, meeting her in a dark place.
And also joining us by telephone is Steve Wolf. He's the editor-in-chief of ESPN Books. He also contributed an essay to the book. It's entitled Grr. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
Rebecca, in the introduction to this collection, you write of your own father, "If he was happy that I chose to play basketball, he never explicitly said so." Will that be your approach if your children get serious about a sport?
I just want my kids, our kids, to find something that they love to do. And our oldest daughter, who is 5, tried basketball for the first time at our local Y this past winter, and I was her coach. And after 5 weeks and our team scoring a total of 2 baskets, she told me, Mom, I want to take a break from basketball. And I totally supported that. And she recently told me that she might want to try basketball again, which would be great. So if they want to play, I'll be right there. If they don't want to play, I'm totally fine with that as well.
You played for national champions at UConn, a gold medal-winning Olympic team, and, of course, in the WNBA. And throughout that career, whenever you approached the free throw line, your father would shout, "On your toes!" Did you ever find yourself rolling your eyes at that reminder?
A little bit. Probably more when I was in high school and college, and I'd get up there, and it was always, "On your toes, B, on your toes." But as I got older, it was such sort of a familiar, my parents weren't in my pro career able to be at all of the games. So it was comforting, and it was nice to kind of listen for it as I got older.
Still, I thought it was inappropriate when he yelled that just before we took our vows at the wedding.
Well, Steve, your essay, Arsenal Girls, and the title certainly surprised me, establishes that Siobhan and Maeve, your daughters, are soccer fans. Tell us what turned them off about American football.
Well, they became soccer fans by default. I would like to lie on the couch on weekends, weekdays for that matter, and watch sports. And one day my daughter was in there watching, sneaking into the room inch by inch, afraid of what was going to be on TV. And when the metallic robot that's on Fox's NFL coverage just popped out unannounced on the screen as it does, she ran shrieking out of the room, and I realized she was terrified. And it is kind of terrifying, that robot. And what she loved first about watching televised soccer was there were no commercial breaks, there were no robots popping out of the TV, and it was something that wasn't going to terrify her initially.
Steve Wolf, you have faced an unusual dad's daughters and sports challenge. You are the father of twins, one of whom is a good athlete. The problem is that the other one is a great athlete. Have I got that about right?
You do have that right. We enjoy watching them both play, no matter the level of what they're playing. They actually play 3 different sports, 6 sports in all. Elizabeth is a hockey, soccer, and lacrosse player, and Eve is a field hockey, squash, and softball player.
Well, how have you handled the discrepancy between the amount of praise Eve and Elizabeth have gotten for their athletic achievements?
Well, we sort of keep it in context of the level that they're playing, the level of competition they're playing in. We're just as complimentary and just as supportive of Eve, even though the level of soccer she played at wasn't quite as high as Elizabeth's. And because they have different sports, it's much easier to do that. This was actually a great spring for us because for the first time, Eve had a slight superiority over Elizabeth because Eve got a varsity letter in softball and Elizabeth only played JV lacrosse.
Rebecca, there are so many stories of Little League and hockey dads, tennis and gymnastics moms, and so forth, parents who've ruined their children's experiences in sports and sometimes ruined their children. Do you see the essays in this book as kind of an antidote to that sort of horror story?
A little bit. What's nice about the essays in this story is they're so different, So I really enjoyed reading and just learning about more of the dynamics that parents go through with their children, especially now that I'm on the other side of it. And as our daughters and son get older and perhaps start playing sports to understand what other people have been through.
And don't say perhaps, Rebecca. With four college tuitions to pay in the future, they're going to be playing sports at the earliest age possible.
Bill, the one thing I notice about the book, we have a number of professional athletes weighing in, either as fathers or as daughters, was the sort of common sense that they all experienced, that the successful athletes weren't really the product of stage mothers and fathers. They had parents who understood and kept the right perspective. I was actually struck by how normal their childhoods were.
Still, it's tough, I think, for children who aspire to be good athletes and even great athletes, professional athletes, to sometimes be playing in the shadow of parents who were very successful. Rebecca, do you ever worry about that?
A little bit. You know, my only concern is I hope my children don't decide to not play sports because I did. You know, from the time they were little and the baby Bjorn with me pushing them through the grocery store and infants, people would come up and say, you know, are you going to play basketball like your mom? And, you know, sometimes people will come over and ask me to sign things. I sign a basketball or sign a T-shirt, and I just see my 3.5-year-old looking up at me and saying, why are you writing on that shirt, Mommy? And you can't do that. You don't do that with my clothes. You don't do that with any of yours. But, you know, whenever anyone asks them or asks me, are they going to play basketball? And I'll say they're going to do whatever it is that they want to do, and hopefully that message is reinforced to them.
And they have a very different perspective growing up with Rebecca as a mother and growing up in Connecticut. We were watching the UConn men play in the NCAA tournament this year, and our 5-year-old Siobhan came into the room and looked at the TV, looked at me and said, are those boys playing? And I said, yes, they are. And she said, I didn't know boys played basketball too.
Well, Steve and Rebecca, tomorrow being Father's Day, any special plans?
Steve?
Well, I guess there's no surprises if that's the case, since Rebecca doesn't seem to have any plans.
We will make sure that Steve has a wonderful, wonderful Father's Day. And the girls have already said, you know, hopefully Daddy will sleep in and we can surprise him by bringing home lots of ice cream. So I don't know if that's their wish for him or if they're seeing or maybe we can go and get some rated G movies for him like we did last year.
And Steve Wolf, what about you? Any Father's Day plans?
I think they will take me to a restaurant that I love and they hate.
Fathers and Daughters in Sports is a collection of essays about, well, fathers and daughters in sports. It's published by Ballantine Books, and Rebecca Lobo wrote the introduction. Her husband, Steve Russian, contributed an essay. They both joined me from Connecticut. Rebecca and Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
And Steve Wolf, one of the contributors to the book, also the editor-in-chief of ESPN Books. Steve, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Bill, and happy Father's Day to everyone.
Thank you. This is the tale of two cars, or at least in part, it's that sort of tale, and one of the cars is a 1936 Bentley Le Mans Special. It is owned and driven by Frank Walcott, who also restored it, and it features, among other things, a handcrafted wooden rear-mounted toolbox, which didn't strike me as standard equipment.
No, actually, I made that. The tire went right back up to the end, and I didn't like the line, so I did that.
Frank Walcott has done all the rest of the work on this Bentley as well.
The chrome is not chrome. It's all nickel, which is very expensive to do and maintain. The body is leather, as you can see, covered over wood. And that made the car much lighter than steel.
This is the actual outside of the body. It's leather.
You can feel it with your hand there. It's leather.
It is leather, and the Bentley Le Mans Special looks pretty much as it must have looked on the showroom floor in 1936, except for that handcrafted toolbox. What should shine on the car shines, and the driver's seat looks as if nobody's ever eaten a donut in it. Even the engine gleams, all of which no doubt strikes Sandy Leith, who is standing beside a partially blue Bugatti sports car, as perverse and altogether wrong.
This is a car I found in a barn 15 years ago.
And you wouldn't paint this, right?
I would not. I love it the way it is. They can only look that way once. People try to fake that appearance now. That's the real deal.
You mean like distressed jeans?
Yeah, absolutely. They call it patinating, and it's you can tell when they've been patinated. They just don't look quite right.
So you have two choices if you're going to own one of these cars. You either present it as the beat-up car that it is,
yeah,
or you lovingly restore it to what it would have looked like in 1932 or
yes.
1928.
That's correct.
All of the cars, perhaps two dozen in all, parked at the top of Honeywell Hill in Wellesley, Massachusetts on this sunny May morning look wonderful in their way. But appearance is only part of the reason their owners and drivers have gathered at the top of the driveway that snakes up into the Honeywell estate. This morning marks the 40th anniversary of the Honeywell Hill Climb, during which each of these Bentleys and Bugattis and Rileys will roar one at a time from the bottom to the top of the road, where somebody will punch a stopwatch. Among those for whom this tradition has never grown old is Sarah Rowe. She and her son brought two cars to Honeywell Hill from Maine.
I've always loved old cars, and I've been doing this hill for 30 years.
30 of the 40?
Yeah, yeah. And I started doing it with my Riley, and when my husband died 10 years ago, I brought the Bugatti, because this was his, and now it's mine.
The Bugatti certainly looked fast, so as her son started the adjacent Riley, I asked Ms. Rowe if she was a contender.
No, I'm not going to win, because there are a lot more powerful cars than mine, apart from anything else. But I just take into account the fact that I'm the only woman.
So you win your division.
Yes, but we don't get prizes anyway, so anyway, we need to start our engines.
Almost none of the drivers I spoke with before the racing began felt they could win, though some of them had certainly taken power into account when they rebuilt their cars. Consider, for example, Hall Fillinger and his 1912 Mercedes.
I found the car, or the remains of the car, in the early 90s. The engine is the focal point of the car. The engine is a 9.5-liter World War I Hall Scott airplane engine. And
that sounds fast.
It is. However, you do have to be very careful because it only has rear-wheel brakes. So you want to drive about 3 or 4 car lengths ahead because you need some stopping power. It's a ferociously fast car.
Eventually, it was time for the cars, ferociously fast and otherwise, to wind their way back down the hill to the starting line. But not before Sandy Leith, who took over the task of organizing the hill climb from his father 20 years ago, issued some last-minute instructions.
As you probably saw coming up, the course is a little wet, so we're not going to push it this morning. Just find the line. It's very ridged, shouldered on the corner, on the edges of the pavement. So don't put a wheel wrong because it could be disastrous. Helmet required, please. No passengers. Seat belt, if you have one.
Clear at the top. Ready to go.
Ready at the top.
Ready at the top.
As I watched the cars cough and clatter by, most of them covering the distance in between 35 and 50 seconds, I noticed a woman who was meticulously recording the results of each run. It turned out that Carol Bragg's relationship to the event was more than casual.
My husband, Ben, is one of the hill climb people. Performers, what do you call them? Racers?
So when it's his turn...
And I get stuck doing the times.
Yeah, but when it's his turn, no matter what, you write down 27 seconds, right?
That is not correct. I do not cheat, but he does hold the course record. Last year, he said it.
And by golly, with his wife here at the scorer's table, he'll probably keep it.
I hope so.
For the record, after the 40th running of the climb, Carol Bragg's husband, Ben, did still hold the record at Honeywell Hill. Though he has no trophy, no medal, no tangible reward at all to show for this distinction, he has earned, as another competitor told me, the adulation of dozens. On that sunny, albeit somewhat noisy day at the top of that hill in Wellesley, it seemed somehow sufficient. If you'd like to take a ripping spin through my antique car hill climb photo gallery, which seems a fitting activity on Father's Day weekend, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game.
It's a lot of crying in our locker room. A lot of people who care. I don't think it was a dry eye. A lot of hugs. You know, a lot of people feeling awful. That's a good thing. You know, that means everybody cared.
Speaking shortly after the Los Angeles Lakers won Game 7 of the NBA Finals on Thursday night, 83-79, Boston Celtics coach Doc Rivers was no doubt correct when he asserted that everybody in the Celtics locker room cared. Outside the Staples Center, there was plenty of evidence that fans of the winning team cared, too.
I'm lost for words. I spent 20 hours on a bus to get here, stood in line to get tickets, came up lucky, got a ticket, got inside, third level. I don't even care right now. I didn't care if we won by one, as long as we won.
Though it's perhaps folly to speculate about the 2010-2011 NBA season at this point, especially since nobody knows what uniforms LeBron James and various other free agents will be wearing in the fall, it's no stretch to suggest that the Lakers might win again next year. That would be championship number 17, which would equal the Celtics in that respect. In the wake of Thursday night's game, and in fact at halftime when the result was still in doubt, the broadcasters celebrated what they called the legacy of Kobe Bryant. But according to Celtics forward Glenn Davis, that take on Game 7 missed the real story, which, Davis maintained, was the physical play of Lakers forward Ron Artest.
Kobe didn't beat us. Artest was the difference in the game. Ripping balls out of people's hands, you know, getting rebounds and... You know, he wanted it, and he took it from us.
Nobody's sure to what extent the Celtics, who might reasonably be regarded as playoff overachievers after an uneven regular season, will remain intact. Guard Ray Allen is a free agent. Paul Pierce could opt out of the 1 year remaining on his contract to see what he might be worth to another team, and coach Doc Rivers has expressed the desire to spend more time with his family. The Lakers, repeat winners, would seem to be more stable, except that their coach, Phil Jackson, has talked of retiring. But for now, according to Los Angeles center Pau Gasol, the future is not what the Lakers are thinking about.
Back-to-back championships is something pretty tough to do. You know, we're definitely proud of that. Now we want to enjoy it, embrace it, and have a beautiful summer.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
They are said to grow them big in Texas, but when it comes to growing halibut, Texas has nothing on Alaska, and neither does any place else. That was demonstrated late Monday when Aaron Buescher hauled a 337-pound halibut out of Resurrection Bay. Mr. Buescher had been fishing south of Alaska's Montague Island when the 7-foot, 4-inch fish first became interested in whatever was at the end of his 50-pound test-braided line. Hauling the fish out of the bay required 45 minutes. The 337-pound monster, I've repeated that number just in case you had dismissed my first mention of the monster's size as a fish story, was easily the biggest catch in the region this season.
He said, I'm gonna catch the biggest fish in the sea. It's bigger than you and it's bigger than me. And people will come from miles all around, 'cause it'll feed everybody.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a mighty day for England on the pitch. No, not that pitch. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie. That is an impersonation of a vuvuzela unparalleled by any other
I am very high on the vuvuzelas. I like the vuvuzelas.
Well, we'll get to those, okay. Of course. But Boston fans are still reeling from the L.A. Lakers' 83-79 win over the Celtics Thursday night to take the NBA's Larry O'Brien Trophy. Even though we are in Boston, we should offer a tip of the cap to Kobe, Artest, et al., I suppose.
Yeah, the Lakers did everything I didn't think they could do over the last two games. They beat the Celtics at defense, they beat the Celtics at rebounding, they beat the Celtics at ugly basketball, and I didn't think they were capable of doing that.
And their victory parade will travel through downtown Los Angeles on Monday morning. I suppose the city needs a couple of days to clean up the mess after Thursday night's celebration.
Yeah, we had a little property damage out there. There was some... there were at least 15 small fires, and people threw things at the police, which I don't know if that's, you know, the usual Thursday night in Los Angeles, but so they are going to have the parade through downtown. Is it weird to you that Los Angeles has a downtown?
I think they pick a different one each time they have a parade.
Downtown Los Angeles doesn't sound right.
According to his coach, the Celtics' Rasheed Wallace might have played his last game, but never fear, another NBA great is coming back to fill the void. Are you excited about the possible return next season of Allen Iverson?
Well, let's see what kind of shape he's in. I mean, he's always been an entertaining player. It'd be interesting to see where he turns up.
Charlie, last week you said you had figured Tom Izzo for a lifer at Michigan State. Coach Izzo, who had reportedly been considering an offer to become head coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers, has proved you correct, at least in the short run.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to give up the empire he's built in at Michigan State for a chance to maybe coach LeBron James, and he wasn't even really sure if he was going to do that, that never sounded very plausible to me, although I'm sure the money was very tempting. And now I don't think he's going anywhere ever.
Tiger Woods ended yesterday's round two at the U.S. Open at 4 over par for the tournament. It's characteristic of the old Tiger Woods to come charging back in the rounds 3 and 4 of a major tournament. Will we see the old Tiger Woods at this tournament?
Well, even if we do, we better hope somebody throws a bucket of water on Phil Mickelson, because he made the charge of the tournament so far on Friday and has pushed himself into contention.
The Pac-10 Conference has welcomed the University of Utah into the fold. Now, stay with me here, because the numbers get a little complicated. So the Pac-10 has 12 members, the Big 12 has 10, and the Big 10 has 12. Has anything come out of all this restructuring other than funny math?
I think it's time to change the names of the conferences to names that don't have numbers, such as the Pacific Conference, or the Big Conference, even bigger conference.
While the schools count the dollars that inevitably come from swapping conferences or moving from one to another, which fans have lost or gained in this season of realignment?
Well, I think certainly the Utah fans have gained. They've moved into a terrific conference, and they've been pleading after wearily whacking Alabama around in a bowl game a couple of years ago to play with the big boys. Now they'll do that. I think that the Big 12, which was, you know, built on the bones of the old Big 8 and the old Southwestern Conference, is moving closer and closer to being the Southwestern Conference. The Big 10 gets Nebraska, which will apparently now play a traditional game on Thanksgiving against Wisconsin, which has all of my Nebraska in-laws, you know, revolving under the sod because they remember when Nebraska-Oklahoma was the only game
in
town.
It certainly was. The Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics released a report this week recommending, among other things, that participation in NCAA championships should be limited to schools where at least 50% of the athletes are on track to graduate. The commission started pushing this idea back in 2001. So how soon can we expect implementation of this particular reform?
I didn't even know the Knight Commission was still around.
Oh,
I thought
yes.
It had issued. I thought the rolls and the waffles on the buffet table had run out of that one five or six years ago. No, they're attempting to rein in academically a strictly capitalist enterprise at this point, and it's not going to work, and it's never going to work.
The NFL would like to add 2 games to its schedule. Actually, it's not so much adding 2 games. It's changing 2 of what everybody agrees are pretty much pointless preseason games that season ticket holders are forced to attend and pay for anyway into something worth watching, games that count. Sound like a good plan?
Yeah, let Roger Goodell go out there and play 2 extra real top, you know, full-speed regular season football games and see what his hips and knees and cognitive functions are like after it's done. I thought a way to keep from making people pay full price for exhibition games? Don't make them pay full price for exhibition games.
That sounds like a plan. Also, it seems to me this is a little bit contradictory with the NFL's announced plan to try to do something about head injuries.
Yeah, they're going to make sure that if you get a head injury, it'll be in the interest of winning an actual regular season game.
The Major League Baseball All-Star Game is headed to Kansas City in 2012. Is it a bad sign when even the sports columnists who grew up in Kansas City say that's a bad choice?
Well, I don't know that it's just a bad choice. It's going to be awful weather because it's 400 degrees there right around All-Star Game time. Fenway, in fact, just down the street here was the runner-up. But, you know, Kansas City, as near as I can tell, is still a member in good standing of Major League Baseball. They deserve to have an All-Star Game.
Very pretty park. They have that waterfall still,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, I think.
Spain next plays a soccer game on Monday when they will face Honduras, and the Spanish players probably can't wait because if they can manage to win, people may finally stop talking about how Spain lost to Switzerland in their first game. Greatest World Cup upset since the U.S. beat England in 1950.
That's what people are telling me. It kind of surprises me. I didn't realize the Swiss were that bad. But apparently, this is something to make you pick up your vuvuzela and honk away the night. I think that the Spanish need to make it out of group now because that resounding thud you hear is going to be ahead of some people hitting the floor.
Elsewhere in World Cup action, does Argentina coach Diego Maradona say things like Pele has to go back to the museum in a clever attempt to entertain reporters so they won't bother his players, or is he just nuts?
No, I think he has to go back to rehab myself. But I hope Argentina plays all the way to the final game because this guy is completely... Number one, Lionel Messi is one of the most amazing athletes I've ever
Without
seen.
Without a doubt.
I mean, he's far, at least to my untrained eyes, the best player in the tournament. But that said, Diego Maradona is out of his mind. He's completely insane. Please keep him in the tournament.
There has been much discussion of those vuvuzelas that have provided the soundtrack for the World Cup, Charlie. This week, Ernie Els said that he thought it would be, quote, cool if fans at the U.S. Open golf tournament at Pebble Beach brought the horns to the course. I assume he said that because he knew there was absolutely no possibility that it would actually happen.
Well, I mean, I think now that Ernie Els has called it out, you may actually see somebody try to smuggle one in. I love him. I love having kind of this low-level drone going on through the whole telecast.
Meanwhile, baseball has no problem with excessive noise, or at least the Florida Marlins don't have a problem with it. They're going to have an air horns giveaway night, and it's tonight. So can I put you down for a seat up front, right in front of some guy who gets a free air horn?
Well, luckily it's the Marlins, so they're only going to give away about three of these air horns.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game, and I'm awfully glad he doesn't have an air horn because he would blow it now, I'm sure. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
England has won the World Cup. No, not that World Cup. The FIFA World Cup in South Africa won't be decided until July 11th, but England has won a World Cup of sorts, recently played out on a single rainy evening in Boston. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Other than the sky above Harvard University's soccer fields doing its best to imitate the cold, rainy, midwinter conditions at the World Cup in South Africa, this tournament has very little in common with the real thing. There are very few fans and no stands to house them, a complete lack of TV cameras, and instead of buzzing vuvuzelas, the field hums with the sound of traffic on Soldiers Field Road. Teams started qualifying for the 2010 World Cup in August of 2007, but teams for this World Cup didn't get the memo until just 3 weeks ago.
I believe it was our friends at the Swiss consulate who sent out the original invitation.
Phil Budden is the UK Consul General for New England and a defender for the British entry in this grudge match of sorts between various foreign consulates in Boston. While the notoriously strict Fabio Capello has put the English World Cup team through endless training camps, friendly matches, and roster trimming, Budden assures me that his hardy corps of consulate workers and expats have been working just as hard.
We've been practicing extensively, as you can imagine, for a serious tournament like this. We've been out here about 15 minutes.
Okay, so the English team hasn't practiced. But Budden says they clearly have one advantage over other teams.
I think I may be the only consul general who's turned out. It's very good. I'm a qualified diplomat, so if there's any international incidents, I shall step in.
Pierre Dorset gathers the players on the field for as close as this tournament gets to an opening ceremony. Pierre is tonight's co-organizer, head referee for a tournament proud of the fact that it has no referees, and forward for the Swiss side.
So on this field, we have UK, yay. Switzerland, yay. Israel, yay. And France. Woo!
Rounding out the eight teams are Canada, Italy, Mexico, and a group of Swiss venture leaders visiting SwissNext Boston, consulate of Switzerland. Although most teams didn't find out about this tournament until recently, Pierre says he's been looking forward to it for a year.
The diplomatic community in Boston, it's quite small, so we know more or less each other quite well. We have to cooperate all year long on several projects, and today we decided to leave our suit and our boring stuff in the office and to gather on the football field. It's much more fun, I guess.
Many of the consulates in Boston aren't big enough to field a team of six aside plus alternates, so they take players where they can find them. Courtney Phillips works for a Swiss company housed in the consulate building, and as a soccer player, she's a shoe-in for the Swiss team. The only thing she hasn't figured out is which language will be used on the pitch.
When I play soccer, I tend to shout a mixture of languages. Most of the guys I play pickup with are Spanish-speaking from Latin America, so, but then you can also yell Ale and swear in German and English. Yeah, it should be interesting. We'll see how well people understand.
Like their World Cup compatriots, the French team is better at passing than scoring. The Italians have swagger, and the Mexican team is enthusiastic. Marlena Del Pozo hasn't taken the field, but she has brought balloons, pom-poms, and an air horn to the sidelines.
I'm the cheerleader. Some of my friends, they work in the French consulate and the Swiss consulate, so they invite me, and they say, Marlene, the only one we know, it's you, so you'll be the captain. And I was like, perfect. And I don't know how to play football, soccer, so we're a Latin team, so obviously we have to be loud.
As the third 20-minute game of the round robin comes to a close, co-organizers Pierre Dorset and Yann Lebeau with the Science and Technology Department of the French Consulate gather to determine the semifinalists. Yann admits that the tournament lacks the traditional formality and strict protocol of diplomatic relations.
There is basically no rules in this tournament. You know, we just made it out on a piece of paper something like a week ago. The rules for the next round have to be decided now.
Oh, well, good luck with that.
So, in direct for our listeners, we're going to decide the champion right now. So, the champion...
How much did you get from the French to play the semifinals?
$300.
Only that? I got way more.
Yeah. Well, I got two bottles of whiskey from the Brits, so I don't know what to do.
Pierre and Yann count their imaginary bribes and tally the points scribbled down on their damp, crumpled bracket sheets. In the end, England finishes undefeated with a 3-1 victory over Italy. After the tournament, Yann and Pierre had hoped the diplomatic corps would stick around for a potluck of international specialties. But those plans were foiled, Yann says, when everyone just brought nachos. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
Australia's disappointed, and my gosh, the Germans lost. The hosts have got a point at least. The French have gotten tossed. Slovenia was sloppy, lost a lead, and almost fell. The U.S. nearly won that game, I guess. But what the hell? At least they didn't come up short as South Korea did when they played Argentina, who appeared quite poised to skid into a slump because their coach, half nuts on any day, decided it was time to insult soccer great Pelé. Nigerians are puzzled by their side's bad loss to Greece, and Spain was weirdly quiet, and the quiet will not cease unless the favored Spanish can do something really grand in their remaining games because they lost to Switzerland. Oh, Switzerland, oh, land of mountains, gold and chocolate, who knew their modest soccer team would suddenly get hot? If hearts are light in Ghana, it should cause no great surprise. All talk of sadness amongst the Serbs is hollow, empty lies. In Portugal, their puzzled Cristiano hasn't soared. I guess that in Honduras, there are people who are bored with how their lads could not beat Chile, winners 1-0. You will not be surprised, I guess, to know that in Brazil, they're taking once again for granted their team will go through, for that is what Brazilian teams have taught us that they do. There were, I'm told, a few complaints. The paucity of goals in early games discouraged some with insufficient souls, but Argentina hit for 4 and Uruguay got 3, and each of those, I'm sure, was a delight for all to see. And if you are among the lot who needs goals for a thrill, perhaps you'll see a dozen when it's Portugal-Brazil. I do not make predictions. I don't know who's going through. I'm more inclined to just enjoy the show, although I'll rue the day when all the tension and the celebrations end, for soccer live from Africa has been a hoot, my friend. Or a toot. Maybe a toot rather than a hoot. Or a kind of drone. Irritating as it has sometimes been, it's begun to grow on me a little. Yikes. That can't be a good thing, can it? Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern. We had help this week from Kurt Nickisch. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's consulate soccer World Cup photos, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from British consulate member Tony Hughes, who offers his analysis on England's consular World Cup win.
We pulled in some other people who actually know how to kick a ball, so we did very well there.
You pulled in some ringers?
I didn't say that. You're putting words into my mouth, public radio.
Mr. Hughes went on to declare that if Doc Rivers had only played Brian Scalabrine longer in Game 7 of the NBA Finals, the Celtics would definitely have won. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. He's crazy. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.